Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis, and today I have my co-host, Bullet Lewis. We begin our program with a daily selection from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living, and again, the theme for this month has been Loving the Unlikable. I hold it. You are not stuck because of the thought, you are stuck because you believe it. Byron Katie. If we want to be free from suffering, we have to stop inflicting it. Ernest Holmes, Creative Living, page 86. A significant practice that helped me over the years is this. The thought isn't holding me. I'm holding it. The wound isn't holding me. I'm holding it. The belief isn't gripping me. It's my hands that won't yet let go. Even painful memories do not imprison me. I hold them. Clutching them as if they were something precious, something necessary to preserve. We often cringe at the phrase, let it go. Yet when I began to see that I was the one maintaining my grip on suffering, so much began to shift. I realized my recurring thoughts, the old narratives, the deep-seated hurt, have no power other than the power I give them. I keep them alive by claiming them as mine, by giving them rent-free space in my consciousness. It was Peace Pilgrim who taught, anything you cannot relinquish when it has outlived its usefulness possesses you. Freedom, then, is not a forceful act of banishing or erasing the pain. It is a gentle, compassionate act of loosening my grip, allowing my heart and mind to rest, open enough for light and space to return. Today, try sitting quietly with yourself. Make a list of the themes, beliefs, or truths you've carried for too long. For each one, softly repeat, "This is not holding me. I am holding it." Breathe. Imagine your fingers beginning to unclasp, even if just a little. Allow space where once there was clutching. This is the first step toward remembering who you truly are without the weight of all you've been holding. Affirmation. I set my suffering free. Love your thinking. But the greatest of these is love. 1 Corinthians 3:13. Love is the greatest of all healing agencies. Ernest Holm, Ideas for Living, page 42. A teacher once shared something so radical to me, it first felt heretical. To try to fix, change, or manage a thought is to give it reality. If a thought is truly illusion, an echo of conditioning, memory, or inherited patterns, then my frantic attempts to battle it, override it, or claim it as my own only deepen its seeming hold on me. Science of Mind teaches that thought is creative, shaping experience through the law of mind. This understanding helps countless people affirm new patterns and shift their lives toward greater good. And now, this new instruction invited me to look even further, opening a new dimension of awareness. His invitation was simple, yet revolutionary. Love the thought. Love every thought. Not as truth, but as a temporary orphan child of the mind, deserving compassion, not judgment. Rather than trying to affirm over fear, suppress, doubt, or wrestle with mental noise, he suggested sitting in pure presence, allowing the thoughts to soften, feel safe, and ultimately dissolve. Science of Mind points us toward the one mind, the infinite presence beyond all thought. This reframe reminded me that essence precedes thinking. Thoughts arise mechanically, often inherited, random, or dualistic. But the self that observes them is free, whole, and unbound. Loving the thought is not indulgence. It is a gentle surrender of resistance, a reminder that freedom comes not from control, but from resting as the awareness prior to all mental chatter. From there, true inspiration, not mental compulsion, can flow. Affirmation. Love your thinking. Expand your awareness. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, healing. Taking good care of myself supports my healing. Sometimes it's hard to say no to friends, family, work, church, or volunteer organizations I care about and want to serve. But when I'm overextended and depleted, I don't do my best, and I may put my emotional, physical, or mental health at risk. Taking on too much and saying yes to every request may be a sign there is something deeper within me that is out of alignment and in need of healing. Perhaps I am feeling fear of judgment or a reluctance to disappoint someone. I heal when I slow down, pray, and welcome God's, spirits, the universe's grace. I treat myself gently and make time for relaxation a priority. Secure in divine love, I know when to say yes, or for my well-being, to kindly but confidently say, no, not this time. Happy. Living a spiritual life makes me happy. All kinds of things can make me happy. Time spent with my dear ones, the pursuit of hobbies and enjoyable activities, or embarking upon a new endeavor can fill my heart with happiness, contentment, passion, and excitement. Like all the worldly experiences I will have, happiness is fleeting. When I want to claim and enjoy lasting happiness, I turn to my spiritual life, my oneness with God, with Spirit, with the universe. This is my anchor, my faith rooting me in the enduring truth of love, peace, and grace. Sometimes life feels light and fun, and other times it might feel heavy, lonely, and hard. Even during those low times, I can return to happiness by remembering my divine identity, communing with God, with Spirit, with the universe, in prayer, and living a faith-filled life. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, The Moment of Dawn. There's a sun in every person, the you we call companion, Rumi. It is essential to realize and embrace the paradox that while no one else can go through your journey for you, you are not alone. Everyone is on the same journey. Everyone shares the same pains, the same confusions, the same fears, which if put out between us, lose their edges and so cut us less. A very touching story from the Talmud captures this soft paradox of how we all journey alone together. A rabbi asks his students, "How do you know the first moment of dawn has arrived?" After great silence, one pipes up, "When you can tell the difference between a sheep and a dog." The rabbi shakes his head no. Another offers, "When you can tell the difference between a fig tree and an olive tree." Again, the rabbi shakes his head no. There are no other answers. The rabbi circles their silence and walks between them. You know the first moment of dawn has arrived when you look into the eyes of another human being and see yourself. Sit quietly and try to breathe your way to center. Simply breathe your heart open and try to feel both your aloneness and what you share with every other human being. Breathe deeply and slowly, and try not to comprehend this, but just to feel it. We return now to Science of Mind for Reverend John Waterhouse's monthly column, Law of Circulation, Living in an Ever-Expanding World. It seems clear to me that the law of circulation is a major factor in what drives our ever-expanding experiences on Earth. We often hear the advice to stay present in the now, but sometimes exploring the future reveals just how extraordinary our world is becoming. My fascination with the future was sparked by a graduation speech at the Brody School of Medicine at East Carolina University, where Dr. Keith Black, renowned neurosurgeon and director of the Maxine Dunnett's Neurological Institute at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, offered a captivating message. Black, known for performing comprehensive brain tumor procedures, painted a fascinating picture of the future of medicine. He explained how scalpels are becoming obsolete, being replaced by microwaves to remove diseased tissue. Cancer treatments, he claims, are being revolutionized through enzyme therapy. He even described how, with the application of artificial intelligence, a drop of saliva or blood can be used for full-body diagnostics, allowing doctors to consult virtually and treat patients remotely. This vision carried into the work of Dr. Steve Weinstock, a LASIK and refractive cataract surgeon in Tampa, Florida. He reports that with advances in ophthalmic medicine, there will soon be few Americans requiring glasses. Technology is bringing other astonishing innovations. Nanotechnology is enabling atomic-level healthcare applications. Food safety is improving through the use of light and ozone. And GPS chips can track virtually anything anywhere with pinpoint accuracy. Even protective clothing and communication technology are evolving rapidly. The question we must ask ourselves is not what is coming, but how we will discern our role amid such advances. Are we simply observers, or will we step up and be influencers in this burgeoning new world? If you're meant to write, teach, or give, do it. The world is expanding, and so are the possibilities for each of us to leave a meaningful legacy. And from the same issue, we turn to an article by Mary Davis, Honoring Our Grief, A Gentle Guide to the Holidays. Grief is like the ocean. It comes on waves, ebbing and flowing. Sometimes the water is calm, and sometimes it is overwhelming. All we can do is learn to swim. Vicki Harrison. On December 20th, 1997, my second daughter, Angela Rose, came silently into the world, a full-term stillbirth. Like a winter snow, she arrived quietly and covered the field of my heart. I found myself in a liminal space between heaven and earth, where there were no words to express the impossibility of her absence. Tears poured from an infinite well of love. And in those first moments of emptiness and fullness, when I knew almost nothing about grief, I knew this: she would be part of me for the rest of my life. I have since lost other dear ones, and only a few months ago, my mother. When someone we love leaves this planet, we walk the rest of our days with their soul in our hearts. We carry them in the deepest chambers of our being. No one sees, but we know they are there, companioning us with every step and every breath. For all of us who are learning to swim in the ocean of grief, the holiday season can be especially complicated, tender, and weighty. The mere thought of multiple celebrations in a short period of time can be overwhelming. Memories and traditions of past holidays seem to accentuate our loved one's absence. In addition to grieving the loss of our beloveds, most of us walk this earth grieving all manner of losses, from our relationships and four-legged companions to human suffering and our warming planet. There are as many stories about grief as there are souls, and while each of us feels and navigates losses differently, there are some simple rituals and practices that can help us honor our grief during the holidays and beyond. Creating rituals. Grief is not a sign of weakness or lack of faith. Grief is the price we pay for love. Darcy Sims. A flame of love. In the days leading up to the holidays, I find it comforting to bring my losses into the room by lighting a candle in honor of my dear ones in spirit. I keep a tea candle burning in the kitchen all day during the holiday season, representing the light of my beloveds and the eternal flame of our love. Journaling. Writing freely about your experience is an important way to move grief through your body and onto the page. Resist the urge to judge what arises. All of your feelings are valid. In addition to free writing, for the first 10 years after my daughter's passing, I wrote her a letter on Christmas morning. Those letters are precious gifts to me now. Another powerful prompt is to write a letter from your beloved to you. What would they want you to know if they were here? Memorialize. Those with outdoor spaces might plant a tree or put a bench or stepping stone in a special spot. Some choose to create a small altar in the house that serves as an intentional place for grieving. When my mother died earlier this year, a neighbor surprised me with a wind chime. Each note reminds me that her spirit is with me. I have several Christmas tree ornaments inscribed with Angela's name that I treasure each year. Holding space. If you are gathering with others to celebrate a meal, it's up to you how and if you wish to honor your loss. You can put a special candle or bouquet of flowers on the table or add a place setting in their honor. If there is a meaningful prayer or poem you would like to offer, plan a time to read it or ask someone to read it for you. You can prepare one of their favorite dishes, ask for special memories, or look at photos together. I have never regretted creating a special grief ritual at the holidays, no matter how small. And when the season is over and the decorations are packed away, sometimes these precious and tender moments are the ones we hold dearest in our hearts. Small ways of comfort. The heart that breaks open can contain the whole universe. Joanna Macy. Pre-grieving. If you will be part of a holiday gathering and are not comfortable outwardly expressing your grief at that time, you may find it helpful to pre-grieve. A common topic at a grief group meetings, pre-grieving involves choosing a different day or hour when you visit the grave, sit in their room, look through pictures, have a talk with them, light a candle, write in your journal, and allow tears to flow freely. It's a time to honor the holiday privately with your beloved in spirit, being with all of the deepest feelings of your loss. It's a time to hold it all in your heart, your way. Social media. It can be especially hard to see other people celebrating when you're grieving. For many of us, the holidays are a good time to take a social media break. On the other hand, this may be where you choose to share the loss with your community. Whether you share on social media or not, do it on your own terms. Quiet comfort. It's perfectly valid if you choose to stay home and nourish your soul with tender compassion while you sit the holidays out. If being with others in this season of life feels overwhelming, follow your heart. Solitary self-care. Working with your hands, knitting, gardening, coloring can be soothing. Exercise can be helpful. Extra sleep can be necessary. Reducing screen time can be calming. A walk in nature can be a gift to your soul. The compassionate heart. Grief can be the garden of compassion. If you keep your heart open through everything, your pain can become your greatest ally in your life's search for love and wisdom. Rumi. Comfort can sometimes be found by looking outside ourselves and focusing some attention on those in need. Through the act of opening our hands and hearts with loving kindness for someone else, we receive a gentle reminder that we are not alone in our suffering. Offerings. Last year, a bereaved family I know filled stockings with gifts for several children at their local homeless shelter. Often on Angela's birthday, I purchased gift cards and put them on car windshields at the hospital or food pantry. In the envelope, I leave a note, "For you with love, in honor of Angela Rose, 12-20-97. We can make a donation to a cause in honor of our loved one or volunteer at the animal shelter. Kindness within. This is the time to be relentlessly kind to yourself. It's a time to care for your soul with the sweetest, most loving compassion. We do this when we slow down and say no. We do this when we pray, when we cry, when we share freely. All of these seemingly small tools build a bridge between our human suffering and our spiritual transformation. In mysterious and unseen ways, we are growing new wings. Grief asks for space and time, tears and tender, loving care. You are not alone. Dying is the opposite of leaving." Andrea Gibson. This year, on December 20th, I will mark 28 years of missing my daughter and my first Christmas without my mother. From Earth and on the other side, my beloveds and I will be holding space for life and loss with you as we approach the coming holidays. Although I use the word loss, I know that our loved ones are not lost, but right here with us in every moment, as alive as we are. We cannot lose them. They live in our hearts. In the mess and in the mystery, in the broken heart and in the beautiful, in the tears and in the tenderness, in the hardest days and in the hope, in the grief and in the grace, they are here. You are not alone. Remember that always. You are not alone. We turn now to the November-December 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an article by Maggie Whitehouse, "Why We Need Wonder, Thriving in Uncertainty." The healing magic of wonder, awe, delight, and playfulness. There's an old Irish joke in which someone asks an elderly man for directions. The man replies, "I wouldn't start from here." If we don't start out from the right place, then we don't have anywhere good to go home to when the dark times come. And that is an increasing problem in our modern, secular, pseudo-religious world. All the great mystics, whether religious or spiritual, know that we have to start with wonder, with awe, with delight, and with beauty, or we have nowhere safe to return. It's in the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, Stuart Wilde, and Louise Hay, just as it is in the words and art of mystics like Hildegard of Bingen and Mechtild of Magdeburg. It's at the very start of the Bible, too. The translation, "and God saw that it was very good," is a pretty measly version of the Hebrew words miod tob, which are much more accurately translated as exceedingly, abundantly, richly, greatly, merrily, bountifully wonderful. The great mystic Rabbi Heschel wrote, "The idea with which Judaism starts is not the realness of evil or the sinfulness of man, but rather the wonder of creation. Doesn't that sound like a better way to live?" A common start. We all do start with awe and wonder. As babies, everything is new and amazing. We don't know or care what things are for, who made them, what they are called, or how they're categorized. More than anything, we want to touch them, play with them, or taste them to experience them viscerally. If we don't like them, we'll make that quite clear. And if we do, we'll fuss if this new joy is taken away from us. We can still find awe and wonder in nature and sometimes even in humanity. Probably the primary reason we are no longer encouraged to prioritize finding the marvelous and mystical is that they are both unsafe. Experiencing them with all our senses takes us to the edge of reason, to a place where, albeit momentarily, We stop defining, calculating, comparing, or competing. A moment of awe has color we can taste, sound we can see, and scent we can hear, and it radiates at a cellular level. Seeing the Mona Lisa in person with our own eyes is very different from looking at a photograph of the Mona Lisa. Swimming with dolphins is transformatively different from watching dolphins on television. No child raised mainly on the internet is going to understand the primal beauty of life. We all need the opportunity to play with lambs, inhale the farmyard scent, and get covered in straw and muck, or at least see and smell a lion in real life. Until you tell kids that poo is dirty or bad, kids just love poo. Education, while important, makes us define things and categorize them, and sadly, it also tells us that they aren't magical. They're just everyday, normal, and mainly important for passing exams. If we see a new wildflower, we check an app to see what it is called, and from then on, it's Herb Robert or Pink Purslane. Wasn't it more fun when we could crouch down before the bloom and ask it, "Who are you?" When we were children, it would probably answer and tell us it was Bert or Maisie, which would make us laugh, and even if it didn't, it would be the magical pink fairy flower to us from then on, and its enchantment would still be ours. To name something is to define it. In every area of our lives, we let others define pretty much all that we experience, and as those others are frequently disillusioned or just trying to get the brand to sell, we're shortchanged of mystery. My husband and I recently watched the movie Ticket to Paradise. George Clooney's character refers to the Balinese shaman who's about to conduct his daughter's wedding as the hat guy. I suspect some authority figures might think that disrespectful, but both my husband and I now say, "Oh, a hat guy," anytime we see a bishop or any senior minister with a head covering. We find that simple practice completely childishly delightful, not just because it's silly, but because it makes all the hat guys shamans, and that feels really good to us. They are no longer defined by their religion, but by a mutual yet diverse link to spirit. Four paths to wholeness. So, in times of crisis, we need that well of delight, awe, and yes, uncertainty to return to. If we don't have it, the campaign against will begin to pull us down into the exact same energy as the trouble. As Albert Einstein has been credited as saying, you can't solve a problem with the energy that created it. This is why so many activists are focused on bringing down the bad without concrete plans for rebuilding the good. They see the need for justice without having experienced the origins of peace, so they can't bring the rest of us home. Luckily, the solution is simple. It isn't easy because it takes huge discipline in a world that offers us 30 seconds of dopamine on the internet as a handy excuse not to do the work we need for a thorough, visceral exercise routine of joy. The mystics teach that to become whole, a human must take four paths, starting with the via positiva, the experience of joy, and then merging this with the via negativa, the understanding of letting go, of death, and of suffering. The two together lead naturally to the via creativa, where we build the new from the roots of both our joy and our pain. Doing that takes us into the via transformativa, excuse my pronunciations, where we become advocates of blessing and justice and genuine channels of grace who can work effectively in the world to bring peace. The easiest way to connect to all the paths is to play outside like a kid. Maybe build a sandcastle or make mud pies. There's joy in the feel of the tiny grains or the sucking strength of the mud and the experience of returning to a simpler time. There's engagement with the earth herself and rediscovering the talent of human hands in being able to take basic soil and water and meld them instinctively to make something brand new. There's the effect of grounding ourselves, too. When I had stage 4 cancer, lying naked on the vegetable patch stopped the pain completely in the moment and for up to 3 hours afterward. I also amused the postman greatly. Don't panic, I was covered in a rug. Gardening and walking barefoot and connecting with the earth are very important, especially in a world where we spend much of our vacations sitting on plastic lounge chairs, on concrete, around a pool, or wearing plastic-soled shoes. Then there's the disappointment of our castle or mud dish falling over, of it not being good enough, which often spurs us on to create something unique to us rather than copying someone else's design. The transformation aspect comes from all three other paths. The positive suckers the negative and becomes creativity, which leads to realization. Whether it's the knowledge that the tide or the rain will take everything away eventually, or conversely, that there is always a chance to build anew. And we may laugh. Laughter is the culmination of all four paths and a return to the first one again. We laugh for joy. We laugh at irony and life's pratfalls, and very often we laugh at our creative failures. Christmas cake calamity. Back when I was ill, I wasn't strong enough to make my usual family-sized Christmas cake. Everyone said, "Don't bother." But this annual ritual was such a joy to me that I couldn't bear not to do something. So I very slowly and clumsily made and iced a much smaller cake. Once it was made, I had the delight of achievement, vias positiva and creativa. And then, as I placed it in a tin and tried to carry it across the hallway to store it, I lost my balance and fell. The tin hit the ground, and the whole cake shattered. It was still in the tin, although the lid came off, so at least it wasn't covered in carpet and dog hairs, but it was one huge mess. Our two beagles came to investigate, and I tried frantically to push them away. The cake I had tried so very hard to bake was ruined, via negativa. My husband sat down beside me and held me. We both looked at the shattered cake, and he tried to comfort me while still batting at beagles. Slowly, we began to giggle, and then we began to laugh and laugh and laugh, via transformativa. We ate every morsel of that cake. It was delicious, and every time we opened the tin for another spoonful, we laughed some more. The cake became the best Christmas cake ever, and I post a picture of it every Advent on my Facebook page. So the best remedy for cruel and unusual times is to rediscover play and get ourselves back to the heart of awe, delight, and joy, even if for only 5 minutes a day. Then, no matter how arduous the road becomes, we will always be able to return home safely. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio on demand. We return now to the Book of Joy, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, with Douglas Abrams. And we had just started a section, Sadness and Grief, the Hard Times Knit Us More Closely Together. The very first day of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the Archbishop began, when one of the witnesses came to tell us about his experiences. It was at the end of a long and grueling day, and he was trying to tell us how they had tortured him. Then there was a point in trying to recall what they had done to him that he found it difficult to speak. He had now developed a speech impediment. I don't know what it was, the recalling or the speech impediment, but the witness was not able to go on. And he started a sentence and then put his hand up to his eyes and started weeping, and I joined him. At the end of it, I said to my colleagues, "I told you I am not fit to be chairing this," and lo and behold, I was right. I've made a public spectacle of myself. I'm a crybaby. I cry easily. I suppose I love easily, too. And so I think we shouldn't think we are superwomen and supermen. To hold down emotions in a controlled environment, as it were, is not wise. I would say go ahead and even maybe shout out your sadness and pain. This can bring you back to normal. It's locking them up and pretending that they're not there that causes them to fester and become a wound. I've not read this in a book. It's just how I have handled them. Sadness is seemingly the most direct challenge to joy. But as the Archbishop argued strongly, it often leads us most directly to empathy and compassion and to recognizing our need for one another. Sadness is a very powerful and enduring emotion. In one study, it was found that sadness lasted many times longer than more fleeting emotions like fear and anger. While fear lasted on average 30 minutes, sadness often lasted up to 120 hours, or almost 5 days. While the evolutionary value of our fight, anger, and flight, fear, responses are clear, the value of sadness seems harder to understand. New studies conducted by psychology researcher Joseph Forgas show that mild sadness can actually have a number of benefits that could reflect its value. In his experiments, people who were in a sad mood had better judgment and memory and were more motivated, more sensitive to social norms, and more generous than the happier control group. People who are in a so-called negative state of sadness were more discerning about their situation, better able to remember details, and more motivated to change their situation. What is particularly interesting is that brief sadness might generate more empathy or generosity. Participants in the study played a game, part of which involved deciding how much money to give themselves and how much to give others. The sad participants gave significantly more to the other participants. While depression certainly collapses our circle of concern inward, the periodic feeling of sadness might widen it. Forgas concluded that sadness may have some benefit in our lives, which may be why people are drawn to music, art, and literature that makes them feel sad. He urges us to embrace all of our emotions because they no doubt play a necessary role in our lives. Sadness is in many ways the emotion that causes us to reach out to one another in support and solidarity. The Archbishop expressed it quite wonderfully when he explained, "We don't really get close to others if our relationship is made up of unending hunky-doriness. It is the hard times, the painful times, the sadness and the grief that knit us more closely together." A funeral is perhaps the most obvious example of this weaving of our relationships and community together. But even tears are a signal to others that we need comfort and kindness, that we are vulnerable and need help. We try so hard to separate joy and sorrow into their own boxes, but the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama tell us that they are inevitably fastened together. Neither advocate the kind of fleeting happiness, often called hedonic happiness, that requires only positive states and banishes feelings like sadness to emotional exile. The kind of happiness that they describe is often called eudaimonic happiness and is characterized by self-understanding, meaning, growth, and acceptance, including life's inevitable suffering, sadness, and grief. "I often receive questions," the Dalai Lama said, "from those whose dear friend or parent or even child has passed away. They ask me, what should I do? I share with them from my own experience. My beloved main teacher who gave me my monk's ordination died, and I was really grief-stricken. While he was alive, I always felt like he was a solid rock behind me that I could lean on. I really felt very, very sad and full of grief when he passed away." The way through the sadness and grief that comes from great loss is to use it as motivation and to generate a deeper sense of purpose. When my teacher passed away, I used to think that now I have even more responsibility to fulfill his wishes. So my sadness translated into more enthusiasm, more determination. I have told those who have lost their dear friend or family member, it is very sad, but this sadness should translate into more determination to fulfill their wishes. If the one you have lost could see you and you are determined and full of hope, they would be happy. With the great sadness of the loss, one can live in an even more meaningful life. Sadness and grief are, of course, natural human responses to loss, but if your focus remains on the loved one you have just lost, the experience is less likely to lead to despair. In contrast, if your focus while grieving remains mostly on yourself, what am I going to do now? How can I cope? Then there is a greater danger of going down the path of despair and depression. So again, so much depends on how we respond to our experience of loss and sadness. The Dalai Lama mentioned the famous Buddhist story of the woman who had lost her child and was inconsolable in her grief, carrying her dead child throughout the land, begging for someone to help heal her child. When she came to the Buddha, she begged him to help her. He told her he could help her if she would collect mustard seeds for the medicine. She eagerly agreed, but then the Buddha explained that the mustard seeds needed to come from a house that had not been touched by death. When the woman visited each house in search of the mustard seeds that might heal her son, she discovered that there was no house that had not suffered the loss of a parent or a spouse or a child. Seeing that her suffering was not unique, she was able to bury her child in the forest and release her grief. My friend Gordon Wheeler, who is a psychologist, explains that grief is the reminder of the depth of our love. Without love, there is no grief. So when we feel our grief, uncomfortable and aching as it may be, it is actually a reminder of the beauty of that love now lost. I'll never forget calling Gordon while I was traveling and hearing him say that he was out to dinner by himself after the loss of a dear friend, so he could feel his grief. He knew that in the blinking and buzzing world of our lives, it is so easy to delete the past and move on to the next moment. To linger in the longing, the loss, the yearning is a way of feeling the rich and embroidered texture of life, the torn cloth of our world that is endlessly being ripped and rewoven. Despair. The world is in such turmoil. It was time to ask the question that people from around the world most wanted me to ask. A question not about joy, but about sorrow, and not about theirs, but about others. People all over the world wanted to know how they could possibly live with joy in a world so filled with sorrow and suffering. A woman named Dawn, who sent in a question, asked it this way. The world is in such turmoil. War, starvation, terrorism, pollution, genocide. My heart hurts for these issues. How do I find joy in the midst of such large world problems? You're the elder, the Dalai Lama said, gesturing to the Archbishop. You show your humanity, the Archbishop began, by how you see yourself not as apart from others, but from your connection to others. I have frequently wept about the things such as the ones you have mentioned. God created us and said, go now, my child, you have freedom. And God has such an incredible reverence for that freedom that God would much rather we went freely to hell than compel us to come to heaven. Yes, we're capable of the most awful atrocities. We can give a catalog, and God weeps until there are those who say, I do want to try to do something. It is good also to remember that we have a fantastic capacity for goodness. And then you look again, and you see those doctors and nurses from other parts of the world who go into those situations. I mean, you think of, say, Doctors Without Borders. Why do they go there? I mean, they could stay in France or wherever and have a wonderful practice, but they don't. They go off to some of the most poverty-stricken places. You've seen it with Ebola. People go into a hugely dangerous situation, coming from countries where they don't have Ebola, and they have no reason to go to Sierra Leone or wherever. They're just showing us what we are all capable of being. And by proxy, we link ourselves to those and try as much as we can to enter into who we are, people of compassion. What can you do to help change that situation? You might not be able to do a great deal, but start where you are and do what you can where you are. And yes, be appalled. It would be awful if we looked on all of that horrendousness and we said, ah, it doesn't really matter. It's so wonderful that we can be distressed. That's part of the greatness of who we are, that you are distressed about someone who is not family in any conventional way, and yet you feel distressed equally. It's incredible just how compassionate and generous people can be. When a disaster such as 9/11 happens, we realize we are family. We are family. Those people in the Twin Towers are our sisters and brothers. And even more startlingly, the people who were piloting those planes, they are our sisters and brothers. You have a tsunami happen. And have you seen the outpouring of love and compassion and caring? I mean, you don't know the victims from a brass farthing. And people just gave and gave, because that's actually who we really are. After 9/11, you would have expected that those who hated America would have been gloating. But there were very, very, very few people gloating. People were deeply, deeply distressed. Had the American president not hit back, we might have had a different world. We will have a different world, of course, eventually. But just look at any tragedy. When miners are trapped in Russia, people don't say, I can't speak Russian, or I don't even know where that place is on the map. There is a compassion that just springs up. The Archbishop's and the Dalai Lama's conviction that we would have a different world eventually was striking. Several months after the interviews, I was visiting with the Archbishop in South Africa when terrorist attacks took place in Paris. So many people were despairing at humanity's obvious inhumanity. When I asked him what he would say to those who were caught in such despair, he replied, yes, we do have setbacks, but you must keep everything in perspective. The world is getting better. Think about the rights of women or how slavery was considered morally justified a few hundred years ago. It takes time. We are growing and learning how to be compassionate, how to be caring, how to be human. Almost a month later to the day, the world came together in Paris and ratified climate change accords that overcame national differences and economic greed to give our world a better chance of survival. The Archbishop often liked to quote one of his heroes, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who in turn was quoting one of his heroes, an abolitionist minister named Theodore Parker, who said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." Perhaps here I may mention something from my own experience, the Dalai Lama said. March 10, 2008. Every year, the Tibetan exile community commemorates March 10th as Tibetan Uprising Day, remembering the 1959 protest against Chinese occupation that ultimately led to the crackdown against the Tibetan freedom movement and the Dalai Lama's flight into exile. In 2008, leading up to the Beijing Olympics, that day had turned violent, starting in the Tibetan capital city of Lhasa and then spreading throughout Tibet and cities around the world. As usual, we had a gathering to commemorate the 10th of March. After the meeting was over, I received a message from Lhasa that some of the local people had started demonstrations. When I heard this, I was very concerned and quite anxious. I could not do anything. I felt helpless. I knew if they really carried out demonstrations, it would actually result only in more suffering, more problems. And this is exactly what happened. With the violent crackdown and the death and imprisonment of so many Tibetans who had participated in the protests. Over the next few days, during my meditation, I actually visualized some of those Chinese local authorities and did one of our practices called Tonglen, literally meaning giving and taking. I tried to take on their fear, anger, suspicion, and to give them my love, my forgiveness. Of course, this would have no physical effect on the ground. It would not change the situation. But you see, mentally, it was very, very helpful to keep a calm mind. It was a good opportunity to practice forgiveness and compassion. So I think that every person has the same sort of opportunity, this same capacity. I do at times get very angry with God, the Archbishop then added, laughing. Some of my friends, the Dalai Lama said, when they are really facing some trouble, sometimes they complain at the Buddha. So, similar idea. Yes, the Archbishop continued. I usually would go to my chapel if I had something that really upset me. I would lambast God. The prophet Jeremiah would say to God, "You misled me. You called me to be a prophet, and I said, I don't want to be a prophet. And you said, no, I will be with you. All you have made me say to these people, people I love very much, is to condemn them. And yes, that is how I do it. Jeremiah is my favorite prophet in the Bible for precisely this honesty that he had. You can go to God and speak all you have, pouring it out in that fashion." I wondered how many times the Archbishop, like Jeremiah, had told God he did not want to be a prophet. I weep when something has happened where I may not be able to assist. I acknowledge that it is something I can do very little about. I remember one of the times that I was quite despairing. Chris Honey was one of our most incredible young leaders. There was no doubt he was going to succeed Nelson Mandela, but then he was assassinated just before Easter, leading up to our first democratic elections. I was at the cathedral in Cape Town when I heard. I was stunned, as were most South Africans. I got back home to Bishop's Court. Leah said to me that there have been many calls about Chris Honey. I broke down, and Leah held me like I was a baby. I think it helped because later on I had to go and preach at his funeral. And we had a huge crowd of people who were very, very, very angry. I knew how they felt because I had been through the same sort of thing. And I could appeal to them not from a superior position, from a position of one who was with them and who had felt the same anguish and pain. It is also good to recognize, speaking from our struggle against apartheid, how incredibly noble people are. You know, human beings are basically good. You know that's where we have to start, that everything else is an aberration. Anything that swerves away from that is the exception, even when now and again they can be very frustrating. People are remarkably, remarkably, remarkably good, incredible in their generosity. And we had the opportunity of seeing this, especially during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. It was amazing to listen to people who had suffered, not only Black people, you know, white people too, not only South Africans, but Americans. There was a family whose daughter had been killed, brutally killed, who came and said they supported the granting of amnesty to those who had killed their daughter so gruesomely. The parents had even opened a nonprofit to help people in the township where their daughter had been murdered, and they had even employed the men who had killed their daughter and whose amnesty they had supported. We've always got to be recognizing that despite the aberrations, the fundamental thing about humanity, about humankind, about people, is that they are good. They were made good, and they really want to be good. Yes, there are many, many things that can depress us, but there also are very many things that are fantastic about our world. Unfortunately, the media do not report on these because they are not seen as news. I think you are right, the Dalai Lama said. When bad things happen, they become news, and it is easy to feel like our basic human nature is to kill or to rape or to be corrupt. Then we can feel that there is not much hope for our future. All these things happen, but they are unusual, which is why they become news. There are millions and millions of children who are loved by their parents every day. Then in school, their teachers care for them. Okay, maybe there are some bad teachers, but most of them really are kind and caring. Then in the hospital, every day, millions of people receive immense caring. But this is so common that none of it becomes news. We take it for granted. When we look at the news, we must keep this more holistic view. Yes, this or that terrible thing has happened. No doubt there are very negative things, but at the same time, there are many more positive things happening in our world. We must have a sense of proportion and a wider perspective. Then we will not feel despair when we see these sad things. Neither man was asking us to look at the world through rose-colored glasses or to not see the world with anything but a searingly honest view. The Archbishop even discouraged people from being optimistic. You've spoken, Archbishop, very powerfully about how hope is not the same as optimism. Could you tell us a little bit about the distinction you make? Hope, the Archbishop said, is quite different from optimism, which is more superficial and liable to become pessimism when the circumstances change. Hope is something much deeper. I mentioned earlier about Chris Hani, whose assassination occurred at a very critical point in the negotiations for a new democratic South Africa. We were on the edge of a precipice. It was so serious that the then president, the white president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk, asked Nelson Mandela to address the nation. That incident could have caused the collapse of the negotiations, but it didn't, in fact. We were fortunate that we had someone like Nelson Mandela. Now, if you had been an optimist, you would have said, well, the assassination of Chris Hani is really the end of everything. What made people want to go on going on, holding on by the skin of their teeth, was not optimism, but hope. Dogged, inextinguishable hope. I say to people that I'm not an optimist, because that, in a sense, is something that depends on feelings more than the actual reality. We feel optimistic or we feel pessimistic. Now, hope is different, and that is based not on the ephemerality of feelings, but on the firm ground of conviction. I believe with a steadfast faith that there can never be a situation that is utterly, totally hopeless. Hope is deeper and very, very close to unshakable. It's in the pit of your tummy. It's not in your head. It's all here, he said, pointing to his abdomen. Despair can come from deep grief, but it can also be a defense against the risks of bitter disappointment and shattering heartbreak. Resignation and cynicism are easier, more self-soothing postures that do not require the raw vulnerability and tragic risk of hope. To choose hope is to step firmly forward into the howling wind, bearing one's chest to the elements, knowing that in time, the storm will pass. As the Archbishop was explaining, hope is the antidote to despair. Yet hope requires faith, even if that faith is in nothing more than human nature or the very persistence of life to find a way. Hope is also nurtured by relationship, by community, whether that community is a literal one or one fashioned from the long memory of human striving, whose membership includes Gandhi, King, Mandela, and countless others. Despair turns us inward. Hope sends us into the arms of others. And then the Archbishop turned to me and made it so personal, yet so universal. In many ways, it's the same kind of thing as love. Why did you propose to Rachel? What made you think it was going to last? You know you didn't have evidence. A lot of people were as madly in love as you were with her early on, and a few years later, they divorced. But you knew in the depth of your being, this is she for me. As she also said, this is he for me. And, well, he said with a laugh, you turned out to be right. Loneliness. No need for introduction. Throughout society today, people feel great loneliness, the Dalai Lama said as we began our discussion after tea. We were talking about loneliness and alienation and some troubling recent statistics. A study by sociologist Lynn Smith Lovin had found that the number of close friends people report having has reduced from 3 to 2. While we might have hundreds of Facebook friends, our true close friends are decreasing. Perhaps most concerning of all, 1 in 10 people said they had no close friendships at all. Actually, in America and in India also, the Dalai Lama continued, people in the big cities are very busy, and although they may see each other's faces or even know each other for several years, they have practically no human connection. So when something happens, people feel lonely because they have no one they can turn to for help or support. Having grown up in Manhattan, surrounded by 7 million New Yorkers, I knew exactly what the Dalai Lama was saying. As a boy, I never really met the people who lived on our apartment floor. I would occasionally hear their doors close with an empty metallic clang and locks turn behind them. If we did see them while waiting for the elevator, few words were spoken and eyes were averted. I was always bewildered by this willful avoidance and finally concluded that it must have been a defense against the crush of so many people crowded together. In rural areas, farmers have had a stronger sense of community, the Dalai Lama explained. So when someone or some family is facing a problem, you have the feeling that you can ask your neighbors for help. Even in big cities with millions of people, we still have the responsibility for each other, whether we know each other or not. I thought of the locked doors on our apartment building floor. How could we have responsibility for people we did not even know? Those closed doors and the unseen people behind them were like a constant reminder that we were not connected. Now, as the Dalai Lama was speaking, I wondered if the averted eyes of my childhood, waiting for the elevator or in the subway, were perhaps the shame of being physically close and emotionally distant. We are the same human beings, the Dalai Lama said, returning to one of his most profound refrains. No need for introduction. Same human face. When we see one another, we immediately know this is a human brother or sister. Whether you know them or not, you can smile and say hello. I thought of the times that I had smiled and spoken with warmth to the person waiting for an elevator or standing in a subway. Yes, sometimes my bid for human connection was met with confusion, since it was not the social expectation, but most often there was a relieved smile, as if we had broken a trance and were once again acknowledging our human bond. Our whole society has a materialistic culture, the Dalai Lama said. In the materialistic way of life, there's no concept of friendship, no concept of love. Just work 24 hours a day like a machine. So in modern society, we eventually also become part of that large moving machine. The Dalai Lama was naming a deep pain in the chest of modern life, but one that was so common we had forgotten that it was not normal. I thought of what the Archbishop had said of Ubuntu, how we are who we are through one another, how our humanity is bound up in one another. The Dalai Lama had explained that in Buddhism there is the recognition of our interdependence on every level, socially, personally, subatomically. The Dalai Lama had often emphasized that we are born and die totally dependent on others, and that the independence that we think we experience in between is a myth. If we stress secondary level of differences, my nation, my religion, my color, then we notice the differences. Like this moment now in Africa, there is too much emphasis on this nation or that nation. They should think that we are same Africans. Furthermore, we are same human beings. Same with religion, Shiite and Sunni or Christian and Muslim. We are same human beings. These differences between religions are personal matters. When we relate to others from the place of compassion, it goes to the first level, the human level, not the secondary level of difference. Then you can even have compassion for your enemy. So, we all have the same potential for affection. And now scientists are discovering that our basic human nature is compassionate. The problem is that children go to schools where they are not taught to nurture these deeper human values, so their basic human potential becomes dormant. Perhaps our synagogues, our temples, and our churches Archbishop Tutu added, are not as welcoming as they should be. I really think that we do need for these fellowships to do a great deal more to have those who are lonely come and share. Not in an aggressive way or in order, as it were, to increase their records or their ranks, but really just keenly interested in one person who comes and gets what they did not have before, warmth and fellowship. There are programs that set out to break down that loneliness. We are often alone without feeling lonely and feel lonely when we are not alone, as when we are in a crowd of strangers or at a party of people we do not know. Clearly, the psychological experience of loneliness is quite different from the physical experience of being alone. We can feel joy when we are alone, but not when we are lonely. After our tea break, the dialogue returned to this topic. Your Holiness, we finished our last session talking about loneliness, and I wanted to come back to the subject for one more question. Monks spend a lot of time alone. So what is the difference between being alone and being lonely? The Dalai Lama turned to the Archbishop to see if he wanted to answer. No, I've not been a monk, man. You start. Monks separate themselves from the material world, not just physically, but mentally. According to his religion, he said, pointing to the Archbishop, Christian monks are always thinking they're in the light of God, dedicated to serving God. We cannot touch God directly, so the only way is serving God's children, humanity. So we are never really lonely. Much depends on your attitude. If you're filled with negative judgment and anger, then you will feel separate from other people. You will feel lonely. But if you have an open heart and are filled with trust and friendship, even if you are physically alone, even living a hermit's life, you will never feel lonely. It is ironic, isn't it? I offered, remembering Lama Tenzin, who told us while we brought donuts on our way to Dharamsala that he had a desire to live in a cave for the traditional length of over 3 years. You can spend 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days in a cave and not be lonely, but you can be lonely in the middle of a crowd. And we will continue with this discussion next week. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.